Hi, this is Mrs. English, and just now we are in the middle of Paradise Lost, John Milton's Paradise Lost, and what I would like to do this session is to make a short journey through the first half of the book. This book is divided into 12 sections, and I'd like to go through the first 6 books. To take a look at this as an overview to get a broad understanding so that we won't forget what's happening in each of the books. To remember, to go back in time, this book was introduced as literally a masterpiece of English literature. However, it is very difficult to read. Now you know why. Milton is very unorthodox with his syntax, his word order or sentence structure. Very unorthodox. This is probably due to his incredible education, the travels that he had made, learning languages firsthand in the places where they were spoken. He was completely fluent in at least 6 to 7, possibly 8 languages, including the biblical languages. And this created a little bit of trouble for him when he went to write Paradise Lost. He simply has too many languages in his store to choose from. He did live during that period that we talked about, the interregnum, that period from 1649 to 1660. Yes, those 11 years. He lived during that time and was against the king, against the monarch, probably was present in 1649 when King Charles I was executed, and was very much encouraging church reform, getting away what he called sweeping away papist influences, which would be Catholic influences, papist or papal having to do with the Pope. He probably met Galileo. If you have been listening to all the sound files, you will know that. Probably while Galileo was quite old and under house arrest. By the age of 44, John Milton had become completely blind. He was now dependent on his daughters to come early in the morning and be an amanuensis for him and write down all of his thoughts and his words. He was arrested in 1660 at the restoration of King Charles II. However, he was not executed. It is probably because of the great regard that all of England had for his literary works, even at that time, even during his life. This book, Paradise Lost, was first published in 1667, when John Milton was 58 years old and had been blind for some time. It was written in 12 books, and he calls this an English heroic verse without rhyme. And of course, each book is prefaced with this argument. This was not part of the original composition. These had to be written later because it was too difficult to read. So the arguments were presented so that people would understand what was going to happen. It's very much like what we do in class when I give you a synopsis of something before you read it so that you'll have a full understanding. You have also now been introduced to the very unusual cosmology of John Milton in Paradise Lost. He introduces a very unusual picture of the world and of the universe. He does describe it as turning. He does tell you that God made this out of chaos, and he talks about the pair of golden compasses. The shell of the universe is suspended somehow from heaven by a golden chain. We've already been there. There are stairs, apparently they're retractable, that go down from that to heaven. And hell, apparently, is a separate place within chaos. Milton has absorbed some of these medieval ideas about cosmology. He actually reflects medieval and modern ideas of cosmology. Very interesting. As many artists, Milton uses whichever cosmology fits his pattern for that book, actually. His universe consists of the moon, 5 planets, the sun, stars, and he has an idea of a universe. In book 1, We have the general introduction. That's quite a ways behind us. We need to make sure that we have the pattern and the outline of this story well memorized. In the beginning, what does Milton do? We read the argument, and right away we are told what the first book proposes and what the whole subject is, which is man's disobedience and the loss thereupon of paradise where he was placed. Remember, as I've pointed out, that Milton is imitating epic. He's imitating Iliad and Odyssey. He is imitating Virgil's Aeneid. This means he must invoke the muse. He must give his subject up front. When Homer began his Iliad, he said, "Sing, goddess, of the anger of Achilles and all of the problems that it caused to all the other Greeks." John Milton begins his epic, Paradise Lost, with the of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree and all of the loss thereupon of paradise that that caused. You can see that's very much imitating Homer. So he tells us our subject from the beginning, and then line 26 or 27, he also said he would justify the ways of God to men. He invokes his muse. His muse is the Holy Spirit. We meet Satan, who is the adversary or the archfiend or the archenemy. He has already been cast down into an abyss within chaos. We have jumped into the story in the middle, in media res, which is one of the literary conventions of epic. We are in a place of utter darkness. We're far from God, and as a result of this revolt. And this revolt occurred in time, chronologically, before the formation of the universe, before Earth, or before man. Satan recovers from this confusion. He raises his head a little bit and finds himself in this terrible burning lake, and it gives off no light. He looks to his buddy next to him, his number one man of his top 12, Beelzebub, literally the Lord of the Flies, maybe a little bit of a parody, the name Beelzebub from the Old Testament. And he awakens. They're saying to one another, you know, "Beelzebub, Bub, you there? Are you there? Are you there? Moloch, you there?" And they are discovering that they are not dead, and they even wonder, can they die? That is book one. They begin to build, we're introduced to each of those 12 top fallen angels, Moloch, Chemos, or Chemos of the Moabites, Ashtoreth, you remember the Ashtoreth poles from the Old Testament, and Thammuz and Dagon, who was a god of the Philistines, the one who kept falling over in that Old Testament story, Rimmon, Osiris, that's an Egyptian god, Isis, another Egyptian god, Orus, another Egyptian god, and Belial, this is a personification of wickedness, Azazel, and Mammon. Then we meet some wonderful angels later on, but these bad guys right now are building a palace, and what will they call it? Pandemonium. And this is where the 12 leaders are going to have a great, and Milton calls it a conclave. He purposely chooses a Catholic term, conclave, because this connotates, it brings up thoughts of the Catholic Church. And Milton is purposely trying to make a comparison here between the conclave of these 12 devious fiends, archfiends, rulers, evil rulers, and the Catholic Church and that conclave. And I mentioned in a lecture that the conclave, that is the word used when the bishops meet in the Sistine Chapel in Rome to elect a new pope. Book two. They have had their consultation in Pandemonium, the new place that they built, from all of the different ores and minerals that they were able to dig and find there. Then they each stand up and have separate formal speeches, very much a literary convention of epic. Moloch stands up and says, "We should go to open war." Belial says, "No, let's," he suggests a peaceful sloth, which would be a laziness. And Mammon counsels that they just accept the way it is and maybe they'll get used to it. And Beelzebub says they should check out man and check out his weaknesses and see if they could seduce man and bring him over to their side. Satan, who is definitely trying to pattern himself after that heroic model, is going to go alone and explore the newly created world and hopes to stay on top and to stay number one by doing that. Of course, he's really looking to get out of the hot place. The fallen angels all disperse and they go around to explore hell. They go different directions. Satan takes his wings and he soars up to the gates of hell. There, he has an encounter and a stare down with sin. And sin is his daughter who sprang from his head, very much like Athena sprang from the head of Zeus. His daughter Sin is half woman, half serpent, and she has hell hounds wrapped around her waist. She has an incestuous son by Satan, and his name is Death. Satan offers to give them a life of ease if they will open the gates of hell and let him pass. And so Sin does. Then we learn at the end of book two that Sin, although she could open the doors, she cannot close them. And Satan, they open the gates and fire and smoke pour out from chaos and from hell. And Satan crosses the abyss and encounters the personification of chaos and night. He gets directions on how to arrive there. And then he's at the edge of chaos and he is approaching the world at the end of book two, and he sees fast by hanging in a golden chain. This is book two, line 1051. The golden chain, this pendant world in bigness as a star of smallest magnitude close by the moon. Thither, full fraught with mischievous revenge, accursed and in a cursed hour, he hurries. And that's how book two ends. In book three, Milton invokes the light. Hail, holy light. This is his second invocation, offspring of heaven firstborn, because God spoke and there was light. So this is heaven's firstborn light. And of course, Milton has to invoke the muse of night because he is blind. In line 20, he says, the dark descent and up to reascend, though hard and rare, thee I revisit safe and feel thy sovereign vital lamp, but thou revisitest not these eyes. The light does not revisit his eyes that roll in vain to find thy piercing ray. His eyes roll in vain to find the piercing ray of the sun, line 24, and find no dawn. So thick a drop serene hath quenched their orbs. An orb is a circle, those are his eyes, or dim suffusion veiled. Then he makes a few comparisons in the line 35 and on of other blind poets. He does lament his lack of vision, line 50. He says, wisdom at one entrance quite shut out, the wisdom of being able to see things and learn by vision. So then he asks, line 52, that the sun would shine inward, since he cannot see. Next, he starts his story, line 56, that God is looking down, looks at his son, looks at the parents. He surveys the hell and the gulf between, line 70, and sees Satan there, slyly coasting the wall of heaven on this side of night. He's traveling to earth. The Son of God is sitting on God's right, and they're discussing how the fallen angels decided to rebel of their own free will. They're very concerned about man. The Son of God is concerned, and they discuss man's future. God prophesies man will disobey him and says man is going to have to die unless there is a sacrificial victim, one who will offer themselves. This is in book three. Unless for him, line 210, some other able and as willing pay the rigid satisfaction, death for death. Say, heavenly powers, where shall we find such love? Which of ye will be mortal? to redeem man's mortal crime, and just the unjust save, dwells in all heaven, charity so dear. That was line 216. And we have a beautiful imagery here. He asked, but all the heavenly choir stood mute. And line 224, had not the Son of God, in whom the fullness dwells of love divine, had not he spoken up, and he says in line 237, behold me then, me for him, life for life I offer, on me let thine anger fall. And that is what Christ offers to do. Line 283, God is speaking to the Son and telling him what he'll do when he saves these people. Their nature also to thy nature join. Okay, we as Christians joining the nature of Christ, Christ joining our nature. And be thyself man among men on earth, made flesh when time shall be a virgin seed. By wondrous birth be thou in Adam's room, the head of all mankind, though Adam's son. As in him perish all men, so in thee, as from a second root, shall be restored. So we have this beautiful imagery where the Son is offering to sacrifice himself. Then, line 345, no sooner had the Almighty ceased, but all the angels break out into this beautiful chorus of praise to God. So in book 3, we see we even see little hints of the last judgment to come. The angels are rejoicing, and Satan is at the edge of the universe. He comes down. He's assisted by those stairs from heaven. He encounters Uriel, and he disguises himself as a cherub and inquires, where is man, this new creature God made? I'm very curious. I'd like to see him so I can glorify God. And Uriel describes the creation and directs him to paradise on earth. And then Satan descends, and he lands on the mountain Niphates, which is north of Eden. And that is book 3, the end of book 3. On Niphates' top, he lights.